Good morning, everybody. How's everybody doing today? Awesome. So glad that you're here. We want to welcome everybody. We know you were greeted at the door, but welcome from up front. Welcome to everyone who's watching online. Welcome to week two of our series called Square One. My name is Robert Kahn, one of the pastors here at Reality Church. And before we dive into this week's sermon, just kind of want to give you a heads up of what's coming up at the end of the service today. We will be doing some baptisms. We did, I think, 6 in the 9 o'clock service. It was a great time. You missed it. If you weren't here, sorry about that. Just great stories. We're going to do a couple in this service as well, and we're going to be doing this all day. But here's why I tell you this. Because maybe you're here today and you weren't planning on being baptized, but maybe after you heard Josh clearly explain what the gospel is and how simple it is, right? Simple, not elementary, but simple in that God sent Jesus to die on the cross for our sin. And if we place our hope in him, we can have everlasting life, eternal life with him. And if that was you, maybe you finally, that clicked, something in you clicked, or maybe you did that a long time ago and just never followed up with it. If that was you, we want you to know that your next step needs to be baptism. That's what Jesus said, that's what Jesus modeled, and that's what we preach here at Reality Church. And so if that's you, you have an opportunity today to take care of that. So I'm going to get done here. The band's going to come up. They're going to sing a song. During that song, everybody who's already planning on being baptized is going to get ready. But that would be your chance to just walk out to the lobby. You'll see people out there wearing baptism shirts. They'll help you. They have clothes for you. They have towels for you, right? We have everything you need. So just take all those excuses off the table. And if you're like, oh, I can't do it today, well, come back at 4:30. Don't miss this opportunity if that's what you need to do. So that's going to be at the end of the service. We'll talk more about that later. So like I said earlier, we are in week two of Square One, which is a series that we started last week. And if you weren't here, let me recap real quick what we talked about. We talked about how everything and everyone has a beginning. Everything and everyone has a square one, a place to start, a place to begin. Especially when we're talking about our faith, it's important to know that our faith has a beginning. It has a square one. So all of us, those of us in the room that claim to have a faith in God, that very faith at some point began. It started at some point. We talked about how all of us, but most of us in the room were handed down or taught, given some sort of faith framework, how we understood God to be and to operate, how we knew that, oh, God acts this way in certain situations, and maybe he rewards this type of behavior, and he doesn't this type of behavior, maybe even disciplines this type. Maybe even God appreciates this and he doesn't this. So we kind of grew up with this framework of how we thought and knew that God was and existed and acted and all of those things. But somewhere along the line, those began to change. Maybe for you it was high school. Maybe you got exposed to some higher levels of thinking. Maybe you went off to college and started studying some ethics and some philosophy and some science and those sorts of things. And they were trying to convince you that those are opposed to God. Like God didn't know that from the beginning of time, that anything was ever going to be said to oppose him. But maybe you started opening your mind a little bit, thinking a little bit differently. But I'm telling you, that's not what convinced you otherwise. What convinced you otherwise that maybe God of your childhood wasn't the God who you thought he was this, your own experience. Maybe you grew up in a Christian home with a Christian framework, and you were taught that Jesus loves all the little children of the world, right? We sang the song about it. But you, growing up, you look around the world, and you say, man, there sure seems to be a large portion of kids that God seemingly doesn't love, isn't there? Maybe you were taught that God heals diseases. Maybe you were taught that God answers prayer, and all you have to do as a child is just take your concerns to God in prayer, and he will answer your prayers. But as an adult, your prayer was not answered. The person you wanted healed was not healed. God didn't give you that job that you thought was perfect. God didn't give you that spouse that you thought was perfect, that whatever that you thought was perfect. And so in your own experiences, the God of your childhood didn't match up to the God of your current situation. And so the framework you had as a child began to diminish under the weight and the pressures of adulthood. It couldn't hold it. That's what we talked about last week. And if you missed that sermon, I highly encourage you to go online and watch that. All the Square One sermons are sort of going to build on top of each other, so you won't be completely lost, but it will help you out if you missed it to go back and watch that. You can check that out on our website. So today we're going to talk about a word that always seems to surface in religious conversations, especially when we're talking about faith and the beginnings of faith. Inevitably, when you're talking about the beginning of a faith system, this word will come up. It's a word that you've heard a lot of, especially if you've grown up in any sort of Bible-believing church. And here's the word. Sin. The first one was invisible. I just want to see if anybody could see that. This one is what I want you to see, though. Sin. It's a simple word. It's a short word, three little letters. But man, little word, big problem, right? Sin. Now, what's interesting about this word, we don't talk about this word. We don't use this word in any other context other than church. You ever realize that? This is almost purely a theological term. You don't use this at home on a regular basis with your kids. Maybe you do, but my guess is you don't. You don't say to your child, "Now, honey, when you were rude to your mom right then, you sinned against her." Chances are you don't say that. Your boss does not call you and say, "Hey, I need you to come down to my office. We're going to go over some of your sins." That would be weird. When you get pulled over for going too fast, you don't get written a sin citation. Right? We don't use this word outside of the context of the church. And so it's purely a theological term. And regardless of what religion you might be considering today, what you're coming out of, what you may be going into, no matter where you're at on your journey of spiritual faith, you're going to run into this word or some form of this word at some point. It's going to happen. And this word is heavy because it takes on so much ownership, like sin. Like that sounds like something I have to deal with, right? And when there's all this ownership, I can't blame someone else. I can't say, you know, I am the way I am because grandpa was that way and dad was this way, and so I'm just naturally this way. I can't say that anymore. I can't say that I am the way that I am because of what she did to me or what he did to me. This is a personal ownership. That's why it has such a weight and a power and a presence to this little bitty word. So what we've done in church and in culture is we've skirted around this word. We found ways to not have to say this word. Either we just avoid it altogether or we come up with new words that replace this word. Because, let's be honest, it's 2016. You can't say sin anymore. You can't call anything a sin. Somebody might get, you know, mad on Facebook. And you can't do that. So we come up with ways to say everything we want to say without saying what we need to say, rather. So maybe in the church, you might hear something like this. Jesus died for your hurts, habits, and hang-ups. Your failures and your foibles. Your oops-a-daisies and your boo-boos. Your moral oversights, your bounced spiritual checks, and your bashful blunders. We avoid saying the word that we need to say. And culture altogether has just substituted this word with a completely new word. They don't even recognize this word. They've substituted it with a new word that doesn't even come close to having the power and the weight that this little word does. And the word that culture uses to substitute this word is this new word, mistake. Mistake. I mean, this sounds so much better than sin. How many times have you seen a politician or some official get up in front of a row of microphones and you know, video cameras and confess to a mistake? I made a mistake. Oh, okay. And you as an adult, you're sitting there watching this and you're like, man, I don't know what you think you did, but that's not a mistake. That's more than a mistake. I mean, a mistake, that's something you can recover from. You blew up your family. You blew up your office. You blew up your reputation. You blew up the city or the state or the nation that you represent. That is not a mistake. That is something deeper. Like a mistake is what you make on a math test. A mistake is taking I-80 west when you meant to go I-80 east. That's a mistake. You make a mistake on your tax return. What you did, man, that is something way bigger than a mistake. But we like to use this term because it dumbs down the truth. We don't have to deal with the truth. Now, let me show it to you this way. Now, don't actually respond to this. Don't raise your hand. But if I were to come in here, and let's say I didn't know any of you, and I were just say, how many of you would, by a show of hands, admit that you've made some mistakes in your life? Right? Most of you would just raise your hand, like, oh, yeah, made mistakes. I made a mistake this morning, in fact. Now, if I were to say the same thing, came in here, didn't know any of you, and just said, how many of you would say that, man, you have sin in your life? Now, some of you would just shoot your hand up because that's just the kind of person you are. But a lot of you would be a little more hesitant. It'd be like, people in the front row especially, like, is anybody else raising their hand? Okay, there we go. I feel comfortable now. We would be a little more hesitant to do that. Why? Because it's a weightier word. Let me twist the knife a little bit here. Because we need to struggle with this, guys. We need to hear this. Sometimes we make mistakes on purpose. When that person confesses on TV to a 4-year-long mistake, doesn't something in you just want to say, how do you make the same mistake over and over again for 4 years, and now that you're busted, right, now that you're caught, say, oh, that was a mistake? Man, isn't it something deeper than that? Sometimes, don't we plan our mistakes? We plan our mistakes. Some of you have used your out-of-town business trips to facilitate mistakes. And you can't say, oh, it was, you know, heat of the moment, got caught up in the moment. No, you didn't. You planned it. And then you expensed it. Some of you have a stash of mistakes in your home right now. Some of you have already planned your next mistake. What is that about us? Why do we do that? Why do we sometimes plan our mistakes? What do you call a mistake that you plan for? What do you call a mistake that you make over and over and over again? Worse, what do you call a person who makes the same mistake over and over and over again? Because a serial mistaker just doesn't cut it. There has to be something else going on here. In fact, there is, because after all, mistakes can be corrected. You can correct a mistake. You make a mistake, no problem. I'll fix that. I'll erase that. You miss your exit, no problem. I'll go to the next one, turn around, start all over. You make a simple mistake, no problem. Mistakes can be corrected. The problem is that you can't correct you. And you are the problem. That is something deeper than just making a mistake. And no matter where you are in your journey, no matter what you believe, we all have to answer this question. Not this question. I forgot to say this. Let me go back and say this, and then we'll answer the question. A mistake implies insufficient knowledge. It implies I didn't know what I was doing. Right, I didn't know that going down this path would lead me to this. That's a mistake. The difference in sin implies sufficient knowledge. You knew exactly what you were doing, and you did it anyway. You feel the difference? I know you've experienced it, but you feel the difference. Like you knew it was wrong and you didn't care and you did it anyway, right? Just have kids if you've never seen this, right? Like don't do that. And they give you that look and they eat whatever it is you told them not to eat or they do whatever it is you told them not to do. And you're like, oh my goodness, it's like the little devil right there, right there in front of me. That's what he looks like. Okay. That's the difference between mistake and sin. But the question we have to answer and struggle with is this. Why do I resist embracing the fact that I might have a sin problem? Why do I resist? Why is there something in me that pushes back on the fact that there might be something in me that is at work against me? And so it's not just me making a mistake. There's something in me that's causing me to do something far worse, far deeper, far more hurtful than just making a mistake. Because you have tried to correct you. And maybe your spouse has tried to correct you. And you've both tried to correct your kids. And they keep doing the same thing over and over again. And the truth is, some of you have paid $120 an hour for someone to sit across from you in order to correct you. But still, there's something about you that is not 100% correctable. Why is that? What does that mean? What is in there? Some of you have blown up a marriage because you are uncorrectable. Maybe your own, maybe someone else's. Some of you have blown up a job because you're uncorrectable. Some of you have a lot of debt that you should not have because you made choices that you knew were wrong, but you made them anyway. Are you hearing this? Like, what is that about us that we do things knowing that they're wrong? Let's grow up and stop making those silly excuses anymore. Like, what is in us that we do this? Could it be that something else is at work here besides just making mistakes? And then there's this one. This one blows my mind. You know that thing that you do, okay? Now everyone has their own thing. Whatever it is that you would say just keeps you from being the person you want to be. I don't know what it is. But whatever it is for you, just narrow it down to one. There's probably more, but just narrow it down to one. Like, what's that thing? You know those weeks that you're rocking along? Maybe you're doing really well at self-correcting that thing. I don't know what it is for you. Maybe you've gone 4 days and you haven't had a drink, and that's your thing. Maybe you've gone 5 days, 6 days, and you haven't been rude to your family or your coworkers. I don't know, whatever that is for you. Maybe you've gone 8, 9, 10 days, and you haven't charged anything on that card. Maybe you've gone 12, 13 days, and you haven't went to those websites. Whatever the thing is for you, guys, in that moment, when things are going well, you're 13 days into this, and you're self-correcting. Why is it that even then, part of us wants to go the other way? And we have crazy thoughts like this. Man, you know what? I've been doing really, really well for 13 days. Maybe, you know, just a little bit. It's not going to hurt. What? We reward ourselves for doing good with the thing that we've been avoiding for however long because we know it's bad for us. What? Are we nuts? Is that not the classic definition of insanity or what? Maybe I'm the only one that has these thoughts, but what is that in us that does that? Maybe there's more at work here. Jesus talked about sin a lot. But if you read the Bible and you read every time Jesus talked about sin, it was always from a position of restoration, never condemnation. You guys get that? Like when you read the story of Jesus, you're always like, man, I think I could hang out with Jesus. You know why? Because every time he confronted someone's sin, it was never from a condemnation standpoint, right? He never, like sin never got exposed to Jesus and he acted like the little brother. Like, oh, I'm telling you did what? I'm going to tell mom. Jesus didn't do that. It was always from a stance of restoration. In other words, when people's sin got exposed to Jesus, when people understood that he knew their junk. Like, oh, you know my junk? Oh, okay, all right. At that point, Jesus basically, I mean, just read it. Read the Bible. Jesus basically every time says, so how's that working out for you? Because you have a choice, you know. My guess is that it's not working out for you, and you really know that, but you keep doing it anyway. That's why people liked Jesus, because he didn't condemn people for sin. He used it as a point of restoration. And Jesus could have dumbed down sin. He could have. Think about it. I mean, he was Jesus. He could have given anybody an excuse. Like, it's okay, man. It's okay. I know you're trying hard, right? I know you weren't raised in a Christian home. I know you hadn't read the whole Bible. You don't even have the whole Bible yet. You can't read the whole Bible. It's okay. You know, just keep doing your best. He could have done that, but he didn't. In fact, when he talked about sin, he jacked the standard of what it meant to be good so high that everyone just threw their hands up and said, well, we're doomed. And then Jesus said, but I'm for doomed people. So one day in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is talking, and he says this, unless your righteousness is better than the righteousness of the teachers of the religious law and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So when Jesus is talking about righteousness here, he's basically saying the sum total of your goodness. Like all those things that you do that are good, you know, helping people cross the street, buying all those boxes of cookies, you know, giving to the church, like going to church, reading your Bible, just being a nice person, right? All those things, if you added them all up and said, this is my sum total of goodness, he's calling your righteousness. And he says, if your goodness is not better than the goodness of all of these religious leaders and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, everyone listening to this is just like, oh, come on. Because these guys were the pros. They knew how good they were. They got paid to be good. Everyone knew they were the all-stars. And Jesus is saying, unless you're better than them, not going to happen. Oh, come on, Jesus. Give us some hope. And Jesus says, wait, it doesn't stop there. You have heard that our ancestors were told, you must not murder. If you commit murder, you were subject to judgment. To where they were all, at least for once, like, oh, whew, good. I haven't killed anybody yet. I mean, there was that one day I wanted to. Traffic was horrible, you know, whatever. I didn't kill him, okay? Jesus says, but I say, even if you are angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. Oh, come on, Jesus. You're saying that if I harbor feelings in my heart towards another person, that at the end of all things, I'm going to be held just as guilty as if I would have if I killed that person? Is that what you're saying? Because it sounds like that's what you're saying. And Jesus says, that's exactly what I'm saying. What? What? Jesus says, wait, there's more. You have heard the commandment that says you must not commit adultery. To which they were all like, haven't done that. Right, honey? Haven't done that. Love you. Haven't done that. Jesus says, but I say, anyone who even looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Oh, you have got to be kidding me. Really? Like, I love you. I love you, honey. Jesus, I've never cheated on her, but come on, man. Like, in my heart, you know, in my mind, and you know how guys are. You're saying that that's the same? Jesus said, that's the same. And he didn't stop there, guys. He went on and on and on and on. And he raised the level of what was it meant to be good so high, so unattainably high, that people were there, and if it would have been a business meeting, they would have put their pens down, leaned back in their chair, and went, well then, why are we even here? What's the use, Jesus? We're all doomed. Thanks. You made it completely impossible for us to have any hope. And right before they all just collectively decided to go jump off a cliff, Jesus said, that's why I'm here. That's why I came. because you can't self-correct enough. You can't fix yourself. You can't correct yourself. That's why I had to come. Jesus is teaching another time. And he wants to illustrate this difference of how God views between this sinner and mistaker mindset. And so he makes up this story. And the story that he makes up, we know it as the parable of the prodigal son. Okay, a parable is just a made-up story. And if you don't know what this is about, let me recap it for you. Basically, there was in this made-up story, there's a son that goes to his father and basically says, "Dad, look, you might as well be dead to me. Like, live, die, doesn't matter anymore. So why don't you give me half of my inheritance now, and I'm just going to go my own way." And the people hearing this made-up story were like, the audacity of that child, you know, like we would. So he goes on, and in the story, the father gives him his inheritance, and he just goes off, and he blows every bit of it, right? He just wastes it and just loses everything, and then some. And things in his life get so bad that his only choice is to come back to the father. And so he's got this speech lined out that he's going to give the father. Now, remember, this is a made-up story. Jesus could have had the son say anything. So the words that the son says, you know, are put there by Jesus for a reason, on purpose, to illustrate a point. Listen to what the words that Jesus puts in the mouth of the son are. "Father, I have sinned." Not, "Hey, Dad, good to see you. Man, the economy, it's horrible right now. I'm telling you, I am not a money manager. I'm telling you, I had a good job, but then this new manager from out of town came in, transferred over from another district, and we just don't get along. He's headed out for me since day one, and I can tell, and so I just quit." That's not what he said. He said, "Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you." Some of you have never said these words, and frankly, you need to. You've gotten close, but everything that has happened in your life, according to you, is the blame of someone else. "Oh yeah, I did this because he did this to me. I am the way I am now because of this, and this happened." I'm sure that the son in this story, if there was an actual backstory, probably got taken advantage of a lot. But he didn't bring that to the father. He said, "Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son." You see the ownership there? You see the fact that he didn't come with silly excuses? Now, if you were the father in this story that Jesus is making up, what would you have told the son? Right? Because most of us would have been like, "Well, I'm going to be the loving father here because, you know, it's about Jesus and that's what Jesus would want me to do. So I'm going to let my son come back." But what would it have been at the expense of? Like you would have had, you know, you'd had a little talk. Right? You have a little meeting where you're like, "Look, you can come back, but this and this and this and this," right? You know what the father in this made-up story says to his son? How he responds to his son? He doesn't. In fact, he responds to the servants that are in earshot of all of this. And here's what he says. He says, "Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet, and kill the calf that we've been fattening. We're having a barbecue. We're going to celebrate this fact. And we're going to have a feast." These are the words that the father said. Now, why is that? Because this father knew his son. And when he heard the words from his son, "Father, I have sinned," he knew he gets it. He's back. And what were they celebrating? They were celebrating a relationship that had been restored, that could not have been restored if the son would have come back and said, "Hey, Dad, stock market tanked. And you would not believe this guy took advantage of me and took half my investment. And no, he didn't say that. That would not have restored the relationship. But the son owning his part, the father knew he gets it. He knows what he needs to know in order for the relationship to be restored. Because we are not mistakers in need of correcting, guys. We're not. Perhaps we are sinners. Just spitballing here, okay? Maybe it's worse than just making mistakes. And we're just going to leave that hanging there today. Because I want you to struggle with that this week. And I want you to deal with this question. I want you to think about, and maybe even if you're brave enough, talk about this with somebody else this week. And here's what I want you to talk about. No, not that. Do I resist the idea that I am a sinner? Do I resist the idea that I am a sinner? Is there something in me that pushes back whenever I get the feeling that, you know what, everybody keeps talking about sin and all this stuff in my life that's gone wrong and all of that, and it's making me uncomfortable? What is that in you that pushes back on the idea that you might be a sinner or that you might have a sin problem and not a mistake problem? What is that in you? I want you guys to struggle with that. I want you guys to wrestle with that question this week and then come back next week and hear where we pick up. Just in recap, let me tell you again about baptism. Again, we're serious. We are dead serious. We will baptize you this morning if that's where you are in your relationship. You would say that I am a believer. I believe that Jesus died on the cross. Maybe you finalized that today. Maybe you finalized that 30 years ago, guys. One of the sweetest things I ever got to be a part of was the baptism of this 65-year-old woman who had been a Christian for like 35 years but never was baptized. It was the coolest moment. So if you're thinking, oh, it's already been a couple years, can't do it now, that'd be awkward. No, it wouldn't. What would be awkward is you not doing it. So we're going to have that opportunity. So during the song, the band's going to come up. They're going to sing a song. During that song, just walk out to the lobby. You'll see a sign and people out there who'll give you clothes. They'll give you a shirt, give you everything you need. Okay? We don't want you to feel uncomfortable. Give you a towel. And we want to give you that opportunity because that's what we do here. We want to celebrate that. All right? Let's pray.